Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And today on the show, you know how I have like insects and stuff?
Yeah.
I think I'm starting to, not like disease, but starting to really engage in trying to figure out all the different kinds of diseases and what they do and what they're from.
Well, that's scary.
I know. So Dr. John Hartman is like on my A list, right? Because he's a plant pathologist.
He knows this stuff,
he knows
right?
it. Because it's so confusing. I guess I admire people that understand the intricacies of something that really is so scientifically confusing to the average gardener.
My analogy is I like to write, I hate to spell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I like the garden, but I can't keep up and know all these different diseases. And
right.
I'll buy neem.
But you can't do that either because that's dangerous.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that's, I'm just like in that next phase of, okay, now I'm ready to learn this particular thing in more depth.
You know
what I mean?
I'll listen to you with great interest.
Well, I don't know about that.
I cannot keep up.
Dr. John Hartman, plant pathologist at the University of Kentucky, is going to join us and kind of give us the rundown of what diseases are a little bit more prevalent this season. Because, you know, every year is different. It relates to how our weather patterns are, that sort of thing. But we've got some bacterial diseases, some fungal diseases, and some viral diseases to sort through. So
with this heat and humidity this summer especially.
Those are the diseases that are thriving for sure. And then Judith Jones.
Yeah, Judith Jones owns a fern nursery in Washington State. She's coming to Louisville July 10th and 11th to talk about ferns. She's going to talk to us a whole lot sooner than that.
Yeah, it'll be cool. She's very enthusiastic about...
Almost excitable.
Yeah. I mean, and it's fun because people, collectors and nursery people, you know, that have specialties.
Yeah.
You know, we love Ralph Archer, who's our local stumpery expert.
Yeah.
He knows his ferns.
He got me started my fernery, actually.
Yeah, and Ralph's the one that did the great garden at Whitehall. Which is on the tour, yeah. So if you're interested in ferns or ready to be interested in ferns, this is a great opportunity to learn more, and Judith will be coming to Louisville. But before we get to that, Bob, what is going on in your garden?
Two of my more plants I like the most that are too rare, I think. Again, my whole life I'm dedicated now to getting people to try stuff they haven't tried.
Mm-hmm.
Vitex. You grow Vitex?
Yeah.
It's a really neat shrub. Uh-huh.
And it's old-fashioned, too.
Yeah, mine's about 10, 12 feet tall, beautiful blue flowers.
They grow them in the South a lot.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And they're trees, actually, in the South.
It's a great plant, the chase tree,
yeah. Uh-huh. And it just should be used more, along with the queen of the prairie, the Filipendula rubra.
Yes.
Which you probably have in your prairie.
I do. I actually don't have it in the prairie. I have it in the garden.
Okay. But yeah, I have my frothy pink queen of the prairie next to my blue vitex
at
the entrance to Hidden Hill. It really is.
And both tall.
And there's no trouble to them. You just cut them back in the fall or spring, and up they come.
Because the vitex you can kind of treat like a butterfly bush.
Exactly.
Quite frankly.
It's got the same kind of look to it.
Yeah, you don't have to cut it back, but sometimes a little may die back. Sometimes it won't, but it'll always come back from the
root
system.
And the queen of the prairie... doesn't bloom for a long time, but the pink red against the blue is, boy, I know what I'm doing.
It's nice. And all very tall and sort of, you know, imposing.
Yep. Elegant.
Yes.
The Wishy Estate, what's up?
Maybe this is part of my fascination with trying to learn more about disease.
Well, maybe just being invaded by them and you have to learn.
Well, it's more of just trying to figure out what's wrong when you can't, when it's not really obvious.
You're taking it personally.
So my green bean, you know how I love my French filet green beans and I tell everybody to try Tavera.
Yeah.
Bob, I have planted my green beans three different times, and nothing's
Holy
happening.
Cow.
Green beans are like the easiest things to start from seed. They usually germinate like that. Exactly.
So your potatoes went bad. Your green beans are going bad.
Do you see how I'm like
and
getting
your
a little?
Tomatoes are.
My tomatoes are looking good, but
okay.
I'm any day now.
Two
I'm ready for life. You know.
You look to turn in your expert license, kid.
So okay, troubleshooting like all the different things, right?
Yeah.
The only thing that I can figure, number one or number two. Damping off disease, which basically like too much water, then like the little seedling just rots and falls over. But like literally they're not even coming, they're not even sprouting.
Holy
but the damping
cow.
Off can also happen like where the seed just rots in the soil before it has a chance. And we had those downpours, right?
Mm-hmm.
We got almost 3 inches of rain one day in one of those downpours.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two, that literally the seed that I got is bad seed. Because this can happen.
I'm starting to root for that right now.
No, but do you know what I mean? This can happen. If every time, okay, this last time I planted in four different locations.
But this from the same seed package.
Right.
Okay.
So four different locations. Surely one of those locations should sprout, right?
Yeah.
So if they don't, won't that be somewhat of a confirmation that maybe I literally have bad seed?
You need a good green bean lawyer.
I say
we sue them.
I don't need to do that, but I'm very upset that I won't have my Tavera green beans in a timely fashion.
I'm sort of kidding you, but this I see the problem here.
Yeah, but why? It literally is the easiest thing to get to germinate. I mean, what is going on?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what's going on, and I'm just trying to troubleshoot and figure it out. And keep your fingers crossed that at least one of my four plots will sprout in the next couple of days.
I'm rooting for you, kiddo. Yeah. Okay. Well, you got to report back.
I will report back. And I haven't quite heard yet confirmation about the late blight thing, so I'll definitely let everybody know about that when I find out, but I just haven't gotten the confirmation.
I'm going to bring a violin to the next show, and we'll just
you may need
some background
to.
Music.
You may need to. You may need to. I may need to go get a shot of happy gardening festivities by going to the Fern Fest, which is going to take place July 10th and 11th.
Yep.
And it's a series of different sort of events and locations. Judith Jones will be speaking. But what are the places?
Well, it's going to be certainly at Whitehall.
Whitehall.
And then the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary across the street there.
Uh-huh.
And then Udell and Bernheim.
Okay.
So she'll be there. And Ralph Archer will be around to speak about ferns. And
other people.
Yeah. So it's really it's a fern fest.
It is a fern fest.
Yeah.
So check that out over July 10 and 11. And also July 10 and 11 is at the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden
tour. Fun. Yeah.
Always fun, always good. 10 to 5 on that Saturday and Sunday. And of course, for more detailed information, you can check out our website at wfpl.org.
And there'll be some diseases there, too.
They probably will.
I'm sure there will. You better stay away.
This hot, humid, yes. There's going to be, I'm going
to
maybe.
Don't take your diseases to town, girl.
Maybe I just stay home.
Leave your diseases at home, girl. Don't take your diseases to town.
All right. In a quest to learn more about disease, how depressing is that? Dr. John Hartman is joining us. He's now semi-retired, but is still a professor and plant pathologist with the University of Kentucky's Cooperative Extension Service in their Department of Plant Pathology. And he's the one who helps us sort through all those summertime diseases. Welcome, John. We appreciate your time and are interested in, you know, certainly talking about fire blight specifically, but it seems like this year the disease incidence is steadily increasing sort of across the board. Is it our hot and humid weather?
Well, the hot and humid weather certainly helps the growth of the bacteria that cause fire blight and allows the bacteria to spread internally in the trees. The infections, though, began back when the shoots were younger and just emerging and developing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the primary infections probably began while the trees were in bloom.
Uh-huh. John, is humidity a common factor here? Because we had a cool, wet spring, and now we got a hot, wet summer. Is the wet part instrumental in maybe more diseases?
The wet part, yes, for lots of other diseases, specifically on fire blight, the wet part is necessary for invasion of the nectaries in the flowers. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you have warm weather or warm enough weather for the bacteria to build up on the surface of the blooms, so whether it's pears, flowering pears or apples, or flowering crab apples, the bacteria will grow on the outside of the plant perfectly fine, growing on exudates produced in the flowers. And then when you get a little bit of rain, it washes the bacteria down into the nectaries at the base of the flower, and that allows the bacteria to get inside the plant. And, of course, once inside the plant, there's plenty of moisture there.
Okay, so if we trace the cycle of fire blight, it begins in the spring when our trees bloom.
Yes.
And then what does it do to the
plant? Well, what happens is the bacteria, of course, have overwintered in cankers from the previous year. Okay, or dead fire blighted branches from the previous year, and then the bacteria are also spread by insects that are visiting during that time. Even bees can spread fire blight bacteria from one flower to another, and one tree to another, and the bacteria then grow on the surface of those flowers and on the surface of branches as well. Especially the newly emerging shoots, the bacteria grow on the surface of those newly emerging shoots. And if a leafhopper or something or an insect makes a puncture in that shoot, the bacteria can get in that way as well.
Mm-hmm.
Has UK been getting more reports this year of fire blight?
Yes, we had a lot of reports of fire blight. It varies from year to year. If we have If we have a dry spring, we probably see less fire blight. If we have a cool spring, in other words, you can have, if the temperature, say, is below 60 degrees all spring long, you're not going to see much fire blight. It needs that warm temperature to warm up.
Okay, so how does a homeowner know that they have fire blight? What are, you know, when they look at their tree and scratch their head and say, what's going on with my tree? What does it look like?
If they're looking at the tree now, they'll see dead branches or branches with dead leaves on them, and oftentimes the tip of that branch will have a crook, be like a shepherd's crook. Mm-hmm. It'll be bent over, and those leaves will have turned very dark, as if burnt by fire. And those are the branches to look for, individual branches in the tree, while the rest of the tree remains green and healthy.
So what are the recommended control measures, John?
Well, we recommend at this point to, first of all, let the tree's natural defenses stop the fire blight from spreading further in the tree, and the trees are responding pretty well to that. And then in the wintertime, when there's no threat of spreading the bacteria around, prune out all the infected branches.
Okay. But wait until the tree is dormant and the disease is dormant, too, I suspect. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Will it kill the tree eventually?
Yes. Fire blight can kill the tree, and there's a couple of it have to be a pretty susceptible tree.
Right.
But, for example, we don't grow Bartlett pears here in Kentucky because they're so susceptible to fire blight.
Okay.
And when we do get involved in this pruning in the wintertime, we're pruning and pruning and pruning, and eventually we're pruning it off at the base.
Pruned to the ground.
That's the goal, right. But, if you know, a lot of times apple trees or pear trees will shoot up these suckers from the root system, and suckers, if they become infected, that can go directly to the roots and kill the roots, and in which case it would kill the entire tree.
Huh. Now, you mentioned susceptibility. Of course, the Bradford pear, they're planted by the millions maybe 20 years ago, and we're all paying the price for that. But what plants and trees are more susceptible and should homeowners avoid?
Well, okay. we would expect fire blight to occur in all the ornamental pears. Bradford pears are probably a little more susceptible than say the aristocrat pear, but they're all susceptible to a degree. And then, you know, all apples are susceptible, but the more susceptible ones would include such apples as, say, Lodi and Jonathan and some of those, whereas Red Delicious is probably a little less susceptible. So, you know, check the nursery catalogs and see what they are indicating as to susceptibility to fire blight. Pears, the European pears, as I mentioned, the Bartlett is highly susceptible, but there are European pears that are resistant, so again, those are listed in the nursery catalogs as well. And then the Asian pears we are finding are also susceptible to fire blight.
Well, the other ornamentals like dogwoods and redbuds and those kind of things, are they not susceptible? You don't hear as much about it on them.
Well, they don't get fire blight. They get other diseases, but they don't get fire blight.
All right, so probably heavy incidence of fire blight this season, but as you said, there are a great many other diseases that are coming through your diagnostic labs. What are we looking at for this season, this hot, humid disease season?
Well, for the hot, humid part of the season, you know, we're seeing symptoms now of tip blight, for example, on pines, on Austrian pines and Scots pines in particular. We're seeing grapes, both backyard grapes and at commercial vineyards. We're seeing anthracnose as well as black rot on grape. And, of course, black rot has historically been the main problem that we've had on grapes in Kentucky. We're also seeing anthracnose on a number of plants. We're picking up some dogwood anthracnose, and even though that's favored by cool, wet weather, the dogwood anthracnose symptoms are that occurred, the infections occurred earlier in the spring. They're now showing up now. And then one that's been really bothersome is the anthracnose on white oaks. And this is in combination with oftentimes with the jumping oak gall, which occurs on white oaks. And we've had some situations where the trees from a distance just simply have turned totally brown. Looking closer, it's just, you know, partial browning of the leaves, but this browning is caused by the anthracnose fungus, and it seems to be exacerbated by the presence of jumping oak galls on these trees as well.
Well, 10 years ago, everybody was worried about dogwood anthracnose. Has it been the villain that we all feared?
Yes, in heavily shaded landscapes and in forested areas. For example, you know, when dogwood anthracnose first came down through the Appalachian Mountains, it's probably about 15 years ago or so, you know, they did the surveys in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, lost over a million dogwoods in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, another million along the Skyline Drive and Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia and North Carolina. And so these areas were heavily hit. Now, our landscape dogwoods were not so badly hit, and the only place where we see dogwood anthracnose in our landscapes is where the dogwood is planted in a very heavily shaded area.
Okay. Now, is the Kusa resistant to that, the Chinese or Japanese dogwood, like we heard?
The Kusa dogwoods are resistant to dogwood anthracnose. And in fact, we, as you probably are aware, began after the dogwood anthracnose came through, we began importing more Kusa dogwoods. When we did, we brought in dogwood powdery mildew.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, right.
Well, what can a homeowner do to combat these diseases?
Okay. Well, the Kusa dogwoods and the Oriental dogwoods are still resistant to dogwood anthracnose. They are also resistant to dogwood powdery mildew. It's just that they're, you know, they get it, but they're, you know, they carry the disease, but they don't really suffer from it much. If you have an established dogwood, you want to be sure that the dogwood is getting, you know, some sun, particularly in the first thing in the morning, to kind of dry the plants off. If they're heavily shaded by other trees, you may want to do some pruning on the other trees to open it up, pruning in the dogwood to open it up, mulching and so forth to avoid, you know, the stresses that might occur. And then if dogwoods need to be sprayed in the landscape or particularly in the nursery, these dogwoods would need to be sprayed about every 3 weeks, starting at Memorial Day and going on until August. But now there are new dogwoods that are resistant to both dogwood anthracnose and to powdery mildew.
So can we talk a little bit about, you know, because we're talking about disease and, you know, when you look at it, okay, fire blight's a bacteria, and then we've got powdery mildew, which is, and anthracnose, which are fungal, and then we also have like viral infections that can impact our plants. So there's different ways in dealing with each one of these, right? We can't just lump them all together. So are there, is there a way, okay, for example, I lost one of my pepper plants, and it was broken off, and I, you know, didn't really know if it was an animal that did it or what. But then I notice that there's stuff oozing out of the base. So does that suggest that there's some sort of bacterium in that particular plant since there's all this ooze? You know what I mean? So I can't blame it on a fungus or a raccoon, but it's oozing. So what is, you know, are there certain markers that will tell us, okay, this is definitely fungal, this is definitely bacterial, this is viral?
Sometimes that's difficult. A careful observer would notice, for example, even with fire blight, they would notice droplets of ooze occurring around the margins of the cankers or in fruit that's infected with fire blight. And even in blossoms, you know, early on, if you catch it just right, you can get these droplets of ooze, which is rarely produced by fungi. So yes, ooze, and for example, bacterial wilt on cucumbers or cantaloupes, you know, when you cut that stem open and you can sometimes see that ooze, developing, in that cut surface. And so, yes, bacterial ooze is common, but, most people don't see it. Most people won't see it unless they, you know, kind of know what they're doing or know when to look. In the case of fungi, you can look for fungal fruiting structures, that is little little black dots that are kind of peppering the infected area. Those little black dots are where the fungus produces microscopic spores, which allow it then to spread from one place to another. So you can look for some signs of fungi. And as well as the bacteria, but again, most people, you know, may not have the training or the skills to observe some of these things.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Yes.
So, John, what are the top diseases that we're finding in the vegetable garden this year?
In the vegetable garden, well, of course, unfortunately, we've had this outbreak of late blight this mm-hmm. year. Late blight has been found on transplants being sold at some of the stores,
mm-hmm.
And then late blight is appearing in some fields and in some gardens.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions for late blight right now are not very good. This hot weather is not favorable for late blight, so that's a good thing.
So that will slow it, hopefully?
That'll slow it down.
Okay.
Rainy weather would speed it up, but it needs to be cool, rainy weather.
Okay.
And last year, as you may be aware, we had late blight last year as well.
Yes.
So that's one that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing in the vegetable garden, we're seeing bacterial wilt of cucumbers and cantaloupes, which is a common disease. And that one, as you may be aware, is transmitted by the cucumber beetle.
Mm-hmm.
So the cucumber beetles contain the bacteria in their mouth parts, and when they start chewing on the cucumbers or cantaloupes, the bacteria are deposited in those wounds, and then the bacteria can go systemic within that plant.
Okay. So if your cucumbers wilt all of a sudden, that's
right.
it.
Right. Right.
All right.
And we saw, we're seeing early blight on tomatoes as well.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the season, we saw septoria leaf spot on tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two leaf spots are sometimes can be confused one with another, but again, these are based on samples that have come into the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Let's see. We're also seeing some of the leaf spots on beans, a bacterial spot, as well as some anthracnose. anthracnose oftentimes goes to the beans themselves, the seeds themselves.
I'm feeling kind of depressed, John.
Yeah. Well, not everybody, not all
everybody
plants are sick. I mean, there are a lot of healthy plants out there as well.
Okay, good.
of course, we, in our diagnostic lab, we only see the
sick ones.
That are diseased, so.
You're in the morgue.
We're in the morgue, that's right. And a lot of times, that's all we're doing is performing an autopsy.
Autopsies, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Boy.
But it's good to know that. I mean, that's the thing, when you're wondering what's wrong with your plant, there are a whole great many different things that could be wrong with it, including
mm-hmm.
disease, but not exclusively disease, right?
Right. Right.
All right.
Right. And there, as you know, there are insect pests that can cause symptoms that might even resemble disease.
Yeah, John, I was curious, some of these like heirloom roses that we read about and see, are they indeed more resistant to these newer diseases, or is there anything totally resistant to these things?
Black spot is probably the most devastating disease on roses, and if a homeowner wants to grow these very nice hybrid tea roses, they're especially susceptible to black spot. And the heirloom roses are just as susceptible to
okay.
black spot. But we do have some of the newer roses, the knockout roses, and some of those that are the carefree type roses
mm-hmm.
that are have more resistance to black spot. So you know that's a good thing in terms of the newer plants that show some resistance.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of heirloom tomatoes, for example, or heirloom beans, that's one of the problems we have is that a lot of times people, in order to preserve these heirloom plants, are collecting seeds and saving them year after year, and
that might be diseased.
They can oftentimes collect plant diseases along with the seeds.
Interesting.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, see, some of these diseases are seed transmitted, the bacterial blights on tomatoes,
right.
and tobacco mosaic virus on
uh-huh.
tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
That's all seed transmitted, and we sometimes run into those kinds of problems.
Bummer.
Very good point there. Well, great, John. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time and all the good information.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
All right. Dr. John Hartman is a semi-retired professor and Kentucky Cooperative Extension plant pathologist in the University of Kentucky's Department of Plant Pathology. For more information, you might want to check out the University of Kentucky's Kentucky Pest News. I'm a faithful reader. It's got a lot of great information. And, of course, we can provide a link to that from our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, the Fern Madam, Judith Jones, talks about ferns and her upcoming visit to Louisville. You're listening to Homegrown 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And on to some brighter news, perhaps. Not diseases, but ferns. And like the cool thing about ferns is, quite frankly, if you've got the right kind of garden culture, they're not very fussy at all.
No, in fact, I created one. I took about 20 or 30 loads of compost. Mm-hmm. And 3 years ago, from 1 gallon containers, they're about 30, 40 inches tall.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Just is that perfect, your, what do you call your stumpery?
My infernary.
Your infernary. There we go.
Bobby's infernary.
All right.
Much better than stumpery.
Stumpery. But yeah, we're going to talk to Judith Jones. She's coming to town. There's a Fern Fest weekend, July 10th and 11th.
Yeah.
Different locations. We'd mentioned before Whitehall, Bernheim, Udell.
And Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
For a talk. So it's put on by the Jefferson County Master Gardeners. So, you know, of course, you can check out more information on it by going to our website at WFPL.org.
And she's very enthusiastic about her sport.
Indeed.
Judith Jones is the owner of Fancy Fronds Temperate Fern Nursery in Washington. She has written and lectured about ferns for 25 years and has earned the title of the Fern Madam. She's here today to explain all that. Judith, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
I want to ask about fern history in a second, but I'm more interested right now in how you became the Fern Madam.
Well, I have to tell you that when you specialize in something, people tend to refer to you, oh, this is the Fern Queen or the Fern Princess.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I really don't want to be the Queen or the Princess or the Fern Lady.
Right.
Because none of those people, well, some of them in the past seem to have had great, great fun, but there seems to be more flexibility in the costuming if you're the Fern Madam, because you can, in fact, be just really elegant, or you can be downright ridiculous.
That's right. You can go either way with that.
It's very, very flexible, and they cut you a lot of slack that way.
Excellent.
Okay, we've covered your history quickly. How about the fern history? Let's take it back as far as you know. How long they've been around on this planet?
Well, according to Dr. Moran's Natural History of Ferns, if anybody's really interested in a fabulous read on all kinds of aspects of fern propagation and fern natural history, it's a wonderful book. But Robin equates the earliest ferns, which are no longer extant, but the fossil remains, were around about 345 million years ago.
Wow.
And you compare that to the gymnosperms, which are the cycads and the conifers, and those are about 340 million, with flowering plants not coming along until about 200 million years after the first ferns and gymnosperms.
Very interesting. There's some history there, to be sure.
There is, but what we consider to be, we say, oh, these ferns are really old. They're actually modern lineages of those fossil ferns. The fossil ferns are a whole study in themselves, paleoteridology, because very few of them would you recognize at all. The royal fern, which is a native in your area, Osmunda regalis, which is Variety spectabilis in the United States, is actually recognizable. It's one of those that we have that is still a very primitive fern, but we can recognize the fossil and say, wow, you know, I know what that is.
But they've obviously evolved over the years through, I guess, just natural selection, but also human interaction and selection, right?
Well, especially during the Victorian age, certainly there was that great push to go out in the countryside and find, you know, various and assorted sports or monstrosities, as the botanists used to call them. And, you know, a monstrosity wasn't necessarily a derogatory term as we use it today.
Yeah.
But what is interesting, it was actually sort of a socio-economic movement. There's a wonderful book by David Allen, who's a social historian, a British social historian. And it had to do with the fact that the only people that it could afford these exotic ferns that were being brought over on ships and managed to arrive safely. By the way, Captain Bligh was one of the most successful at getting plants back, although he may not have been revered by his crew. and so those were very expensive, and glass being an expensive commodity, even though it became more available for window glass, it's still the amount of money it took to, you know, build a glass house to protect yourself from the coal smoke and the bad pollution and the Industrial Revolution, people started taking to the countryside and said, well, what have we got that we could grow easily?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course,
the native ferns.
The native ferns. Huh. And one of my favorite theories about why Britain has so many aberrant monstrosities in their ferns, like you'll find a family like the Hart's Tongue, which is the Splenium scolopendrium. They had, like, you know, nearly 400 named cultivars. Of course, some of them were very redundant. So one author wrote in a book about ferns, a garden writer, John Kelly, that one theory was there was radon in the rocks, and that did it. But my favorite theory that he expounds is that the British people themselves were so eccentric, so their ferns were thereby eccentric by extension.
That's funny. Well, let's talk about just the general culture of raising ferns and some ferns for the Louisville area. Begin with, I want to start raising ferns in my garden. What do I do?
Well, essentially for you, you would probably require an area that was shaded from the hot midday sun, the 11 to 2, 11 to 3 hot midday sun, because I have to say your sun, which is probably out today, has a lot more punch than mine. It's 50 degrees today, and it heavily overcast and very, very wet.
So perfect for a fern.
Well, some of them like it, but the desert ferns are a wee bit cranky today. And I have to actually protect them from the rain. There are some that ferns literally, and this was one of Bob's questions, they do grow on every continent but not Antarctica.
Okay.
You would have to talk to an Arctic lichenologist.
So other than having the protected from midday sun, what else would you want to have in your yard to grow good ferns?
And it would depend, of course, on the ferns that you were growing, but generally, general fern culture requires a friable soil with some organic matter in it, some light, not deep dark shade. Everyone's wanting to put ferns into these excessively, in my area my shade's probably created much darker than your shade, but essentially most ferns that you see that are woodland ferns, which is what we're growing, temperate garden ferns, mm-hmm. they actually occur in deciduous and coniferous forests, but in deciduous forests, of course, there's winter light coming down or early spring light. Mm-hmm. In our areas, in coniferous forests, they actually appear on the verges, not in the deep, deep, dark forests, although mm-hmm. there are just a very few species that will tolerate these amazingly dark places. So filtered light or some ambient light coming in the early morning and or late afternoon is definitely ideal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when we look at, you know, as you say, it depends on what ferns you are growing. So what are some of the woodland ferns, I would think, that, you know, are going to thrive a little bit more in that drier sort of situation, kind of like your desert fern that you're protecting from the rain, but so often our dappled shade areas are dry shades. So are there options, really?
There are options.
Uh-huh.
And one of the general rules that I can tell people, although there's always going to be exceptions to the rules, mm-hmm. Is that in the both genera of Dryopteris and Polysticum,
okay,
the species that you will get and hybrids thereof and selections of Dryopteris and Polysticums that come from North America and Europe and the British Isles tend to be very summer drought tolerant once they are established.
Okay.
Whereas those emanating from Japan and China come from areas that, at least this is where they're being collected, areas that have summer rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
So my general rule of thumb to tell people is that, you know, if you know the country of origin, you are going to find that those that are going to tolerate drier conditions and not hold you to dragging that hose around mm-hmm. are those species of Dryopteris and Polysticum from North America, Europe, uh-huh. versus those very, very flashy and showy Japanese and Chinese species that we all want to grow. An example being most people are familiar with autumn fern, Dryopteris erythrosora.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there are many within that group that are even more beautiful than that to me. I mean, I grow a number in the erythroviariae and the variae group. And they, I always consider that they do require that summer irrigation in order to stay in peak perfection. Whereas if you take Dryopteris marginalis, which is an East Coast native, that is one that is incredibly tough once you get established.
Mm-hmm. So do they naturalize well?
Depends
okay.
on what it
so
is.
So some are clumping, some naturalize.
Some are clumping, mm-hmm. some are wide creeping rhizomes, not so much in Dryopteris and Polysticum as in Aetherium, the lady ferns.
Okay.
Such as there's a Japanese painted fern that people are very, very conversant with, mm-hmm. Aetherium nipponicum pictum. The commercial trade has gotten a little out of control
in
naming everything, and they don't always come true from tissue culture. It's one of my pet peeves because I think they're making a lot of money naming these things and they're not quite, you know, exactly what they show you the picture of.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I've always lusted after one of these 4 to 6 foot ferns you see pictures of. We're in zone 6, 6B. What mm-hmm. fern would do that here, and how would I get a big fern I could look in the eye?
Well, Dryopteris australis is one of those ferns that seems to perform very, very well in hot, humid climates. Okay. Now, I know that in, like, Atlanta and Alabama, they're going to get up 4 or 5 feet. Unfortunately, as you get a little colder zone, sometimes that means that maybe the season is a little shorter for growing. So sometimes they don't quite obtain those same proportions.
Mm-hmm.
Although Dr. Mickle's garden in New York, his Dixie wood fern, which is Dryopteris ex australis, is probably 4, 4.5 feet.
Oh.
Dryopteris tokoyensis, which is the Tokyo wood fern from Japan,
right.
That one is also a big 4.5 footer. I don't think he quite gets as humid as you, but definitely, you know, he's a zone 6, so the cold is there.
Mm-hmm.
How about diseases and bugs? We had an earlier guest on the show talking about plant problems. What should fern owners look for in terms of trouble?
Well, there's not much trouble out there. You don't live where you have marauding slugs like I do, and they generally only have a few that they like. I believe you might have Japanese beetles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which are equivalent to our strawberry root weevils. My theory is that you put a really expensive hosta out there and it eats that and leaves.
That'll be your trap plant.
Okay, so levity aside,
start with dessert,
by the way.
Right.
they don't seem to have a great number of pests that do like them. For the most part, amazingly enough, deer, it's not a preferred deer diet, although deer will eat most anything. If you have, you know, too many deer, they're you know, always going to be the teenage deer that are going to try it. But other than in greenhouses, there may be some green fly or aphid early in the year, but you'll probably find them more attracted to your roses than your ferns. They seem to be fairly pest-free.
So, Judith, are there general soil requirements in terms of pH?
Depends on the plant and where it comes from, just as any plant does. There's a big hellebore craze in the United States right now.
Right.
But what people don't know who live on acidic soil, such as in my part of the world, and grow them in acidic soil, is they're coming from Greece and Turkey, the original species, and they're actually from an alkaline mm-hmm. situation.
Oh.
So I actually, you know, give mine pellet stove ashes. So I would say that most of the ferns in the trade, interestingly enough, do emanate from areas that have are geared towards the acidic side.
Okay, so a lower
which you
pH.
Can, in fact, you can use well-rotted compost,
mm-hmm.
well-rotted animal manures. I myself use copious amounts of horse manure
mm-hmm.
And have been for years and years and years and never had any problem. I actually pot in horse manure once they're past the 4-inch pot stage.
Mm-hmm.
So mushroom compost, I mean, worm castings. I mean, there are all kinds of things that people love to use, and all of these are wonderful additives to the soil.
Okay.
I advocate that when you're cleaning up in the spring mm-hmm. and you're maybe removing the old foliage and tidying up, which you don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Ferns have been taking care of themselves, but in a small garden, it's nice to see what's coming up and tidy so that you don't have, you know, places for, you know, damaging insects to hide underneath, then tidy up, give 2 to 3 inches of, you know, an annual top dressing of compost or well-rotted manure, and that's like putting an insulating blanket over so that when you water, that nice water percolates down and is held on top of the soil surface, and your plants, ferns included, you know, get the most out of the water that you put on your garden.
Now, how and when do you divide them?
I prefer spring for most people in harsh climates, I think, is a good time. Here we do it in the fall as well as in the spring, but in the spring they're anxious to push, they're ready to go, particularly deciduous ones, and you know they're willing to get on rather than just be divided and sit there all winter, where you might lose them because something might get too wet or too dry, and you've just sort of messed with their normal range of having their root system out. Now, planting something from a pot and dividing it's almost totally different than digging it from the ground. In the pot, it's really intact on that root system, and you can manipulate it, because if you're dividing in a pot, you can do that in early in fall, maybe hold it a little longer in a protected site, and then get it in the ground, get a little more root growth on it, you know, if you have a place that you can do that. But I think in your climate, spring is the best time.
Okay, great information. We're looking forward to having you come to Louisville.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judith.
Judith Jones is the owner of Fancy Fronds Temperate Fern Nursery in Washington. For more information on her July 10th and 11th visit to Louisville, go to our homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill with a pair of questions.
All right. Go for it.
This one's from Anna Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Good question aimed directly at you.
Okay.
What other methods of protecting blueberry bushes from birds can you recommend? Netting is quite a pain. I'm wondering what they do at U-Pick Farms.
Mm-hmm. Netting can be and get involved because you have to remove the net so that you can get in there and pick.
Yeah.
Plus, the nets often catch birds and kill birds. And,
oh.
A veterinary friend of mine that I correspond with said that he's caught snakes in them before, and
wow.
The snake died, and he likes the snakes like I like my snakes. So some people are sort of against the whole netting thing just because of the casualty.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, we're using blueberry netting to some advantage, but they're not that big a bush.
Right.
I can see your problem with 25-year-old bushes. Where
right. And we used to have a pretty good setup where we'd have those little poles that we could bend and then, you know, drape them over and get it off pretty easily. But some of them are too big now, and when you rip the netting off, you rip all the berries off. So I pretty much let nature be nature.
And birds take their course.
And they do, eventually. The fact that I've picked my bushes so well this year, Bob, I think has offset my bird activity because there's not like a whole lot of ripe berries on there at any point.
But the birds are mad at you, I'm sure.
Picking them, yeah. But there's also other things still available for them.
Okay.
So Mylar tape. Okay, to the point, sorry. Mylar tape is the thing that I like to have on hand for deterring birds.
Okay.
It's not, you know, not a sure thing, but you can use it on your tomato cages. You can use it on your blackberries. You can use it on your blueberry shrubs. So Mylar tape is silver on one side and red on the other.
Okay.
And it's like sparkly, and you just cut little pieces and you tie them around the branches, and then they blow in the wind and they sparkle, shimmer, like iridescent red and silver.
Huh.
So there. No killing birds or snakes.
I'd come out and fire a shotgun for the noise for $50 an hour.
Yeah, because that's what commercial people have, those cannons that go off every so often.
Yeah.
So I don't think your neighbor's going to want you to do
and
that.
And the deaf birds don't pay attention.
Yeah. All right.
Any
so
other
that's
questions?
That's as best as I can do in bird deterrent.
Okay.
All right. Here's a question from Barb. I would like to know when the best time is to plant turnips. Also, can you move peony bushes now?
Well, I'll do the peony thing, you do the turnip thing.
Okay.
I had enormous luck, good luck, moving my peonies last fall.
Mm-hmm.
But we were talking about this earlier. If you're going to sell your house and leave, you can dig them now and take them with you.
Yeah.
just be sure, as they always say, don't plant them too deep.
Sure.
And but you can do it now, but I think fall or early spring would be a better time to do it. Probably fall.
Fall's the best time
by
to
far,
do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like October, once the plant starts to shut down. Don't plant too deep, as Bob said. Do not let those little eyes or buds that are on the roots be planted any deeper than 2 inches beneath the soil's surface.
Right.
Why? Because those buds have to be adequately chilled in the winter. So if they're too deep, they're not going to be adequately chilled and they won't bloom.
Mine were like a fine wine. They were perfectly chilled.
Yeah.
How about turnips?
Mine are perfectly chilled too.
What's up with turnips?
It's way too late for turnips.
Yeah.
But don't give up. But you can plant maybe a late summer crop of turnips.
Oh, okay.
You know, for the, you know, maturing into fall and winter, because they'll enjoy those cooler temperatures at that point. But you probably wouldn't get them, you wouldn't be able to get them to germinate the seed because it's too hot. You know what I mean?
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
Bob, it is a plant story day. What beautiful thing do you have for us?
Exactly.
For once.
Finally.
Finally.
She's talking about me. Well, part of my lot in life is to appreciate the unappreciated.
Good.
Hence, we're going to talk about the marigold.
Excellent.
She's actually a scented herb. You probably knew that. It's probably the most unloved, unappreciated, and taken for granted plant in the history of the world. It is sold by zillions, you know, everywhere for fillers and boxes and hot, dry areas where nothing else wants to live. Actually been around about 2,000 years. Did you know that?
Oh.
It's a native of the Americas, from Arizona to Mexico, all the way down into Argentina. Comes in all sorts of gaudy colors, orange and reds and everything in between. But there's also some newer, kinder, more gentle cultivars, which I like a lot. Here's what I didn't know, and I should have known this. The name comes from Mary's Gold, as the plant associated with the Virgin Mary.
Okay.
Or Mother Mary.
How did she use
Christian
it, do you
stories.
Know?
Well, yeah, it became associated with her on, somehow the connection was made on March 25th.
Exact date known.
Yeah. Well, it's the Feast of the Annunciation.
Okay.
When the angel Gabriel came to the Mother Mary to tell her the baby was coming.
And did he present her with marigolds or something?
Well, they somehow...
Something
connected
happened.
The two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they didn't.
I want more answers here.
The history book didn't tell me that.
Did she rub the marigold on her palm so it would leave yellow, maybe?
I think so.
Okay. That's what I did when I was a child.
Maybe you solved the problem.
Okay.
But anyway, it comes from the Virgin Mary, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
In Hindu, the flower symbolizes auspiciousness, and it's offered to the god as a symbol of surrender.
So they rise it up a little bit.
This is a little less religious. In England, it's a British slang term for the yellow or orange glove used to wash dishes.
So, get your marigolds out, lady.
You got your A to Z from religion to dishwashing here. The more common cultivars you probably know, the calendula, which is the pot marigold.
Uh-huh.
It's a native to the Mediterranean. The most common one is the tagetes, which is the name for the Etruscan god Tagetes, the god of wisdom, who popped out of the earth one spring about plowing time and talked about divinity. And he had two snakes for legs, by the way. The more common one we see all the time around here and use all the time is the African or American marigold, the Tagetes erecta. Which, of course, led to Viagra. Gets about 3 feet tall, but there are some dwarf cultivars. This one you're going to know. The French patula is the opener loosely spreading. That's what patula means.
Okay.
So we have the African, the American, and the French. It's used in companion planting all the time with no real proof it works.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some proof that it works to suppress the nematodes.
Huh. And those are the older varieties that stink more than the newer varieties.
Exactly.
The stinkier you are, the more effective you are.
And no nematodes in my yard.
Okay.
Which lead to this poem.
Okay.
Let's hear it for the marigold, defiler of the nematode, that's traveled a religious road to thrive in your and my abode. It's been with us for 2,000 years, offering color and calming fears, meeting all our garden wishes, being used to wash the dishes. So long we've taken it for granted, once in the garden safely planted. I lift voice today in poem so bold. Let's hear it for The marigold.
Very nice.
Hey.
I have new respect for her.
Well, you should.
She's a lovely. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Poison Hemlock.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Socrates, right?
And more Roadside Weed.
Is that Socrates?
Yeah, I think so.
Homegrown is produced by the pest-free Brad Yost in the fern-filled studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.